Several months ago, an internationally known and respected theologian and writer, Father John Courtney Murray, wrote an article called The Bad Arguments Intelligent Men Make. And in it he said, "I believe that nothing is more damaging to democracy than lack of rationality in public argument. The foundations of our society are indeed laid in an identifiable consensus, but they are more importantly laid in a reasonable disposition to argue our many disagreements in intelligent and temperate fashion, using restrained language, avoiding misstatements, overstatements, or simplifications, and endeavoring to define issues with precision in the light of all the relevant principles and facts. I believe that whatever corrupts rational public argument corrupts democracy." Well, Father Murray was directing himself particularly to the subject of censorship, book censorship. This is an extremely important matter in our own times, and The Open Mind is going to devote a series of programs on the whole range of questions that come up in censorship. This week, book censorship, next week, movie censorship, and in the near future, a program on censorship in radio and in television. Now, this week, for our discussion of book censorship, I have three expert guests who are going to give us their opinions about the matter. First, my first guest is Miss Anne Freemantle, author, critic, teacher, and editor of the Catholic Book Club. My second guest is Mr. Morris Ernst, well-known New York attorney who has been very much involved in the question of censorship and civil liberties. My third guest is Mr. Dan Lacey, the managing director of the American Book Publishing Council. Well, now, suppose I begin this program, and it is a difficult one because there are so many side issues in the matter of censorship, just by asking what your reaction is, Miss Freemantle, to the phrase book censorship.
Well, my attitude, I'm a literary critic, I do a lot of book reviews, and my attitude is that the human being is always censoring in one way or another. The problem of censorship is who censors what. For instance, when I do a book review, I'm trying to persuade people to read a book I think is good by my literary standards, and I'm trying to prevent them wasting their time reading a book that I think is lousy. And that's the beginning of, I mean, that's the most personal view. But I think the whole basis, and this is where I think we'd argue perhaps, the whole basis is the problem, the two related problems of free will, the human individual free will, which is absolute, and the common good for which the community exists. I mean, the community only exists by reason of working for the common good. And those two, I probably put it rather bluntly, but the swinging between those two is, I think, the area in which all censorship works.
But I don't think your literary criticism is censorship at all, Ms. Freemantle. You're only trying to persuade people not to read. Censorship begins when people are prevented from reading. After having read your review or listened to your argument, you can still read the book. That's not censorship.
Well, that's a good point, I think. But I think that it's not absolute censorship. But I think that when I tell my children not to read a certain thing until they're older, for instance, or not to read a certain thing because it's a bad book, as I would with certain horror comics, and I'm sure every other mother would, I think that is implicitly censorship.
I should think that a parent has that power and duty. I often doubt whether it works. Seems to me most parents, when they say to their children, don't read, the kids go around, sneak around, and read it.
Well, that's been one of the questions that's been raised about censorship itself, whether by saying this book is banned or shouldn't be read, you're not stimulating young and older people to read.
That's, I think, the point there, that you have to define what is good. What is good for a child in the child's mind is very often what its parents think bad, and it's good because they think it bad. I mean, you have to present the good as the good to the individual that you're presenting it to.
Well, let me be very blunt about this, and let me just ask whether you believe in censorship.
I very much believe in censorship. I think every parent does.
And what do you mean by the censorship you believe in?
Well, I believe that every private individual has the right to censor for anyone they're responsible for. First of all, for themselves. I think it's implicit in my free choice. I have the right to censor because I have the right to choose. And I have the right to choose for my children, and I have the right to choose for anyone for whom I'm responsible, until they're adult, right away. You see, that's my responsibility.
May I ask, are you against all censorship by the state?
Oh, indeed.
You
against
too,
Dan. I think that's an area we agree on.
I think there is room for one kind of censorship by the state. I don't have any serious objections in practice, though I have some in theory, to criminal prosecutions by the state for the sale of certain types of obscene matter where it's possible to convince a jury or a judge and to withstand the processes of appeal and obtain a criminal conviction.
But wouldn't you agree that it's better if the citizens did it themselves with vigilant committees and things?
No, I would much rather have anything that's going to be done by a public authority whom I can vote out of office or whose acts I can appeal and whom I can fight publicly than to have it be done by a vigilante committee against whom I'm helpless.
Oh, but you agree also the vigilante committee shouldn't go around and browbeat the newsstand or the bookstore.
Absolutely, but I think the vigilante committee should be very careful that everything was labeled. After all, we have our pure drug acts in which everything has to be labeled, what the contents of everything is. The can I buy at the A&P has clearly on it what is inside it. And I think the individual has the right to expect that protection.
How's the play on words? There's all the difference in the world between labeling a can of green peas to say that it doesn't have an identifiable chemical which 1,000 chemists could test for and each come out with the same answer, and labeling a book to say that this has a bad idea when this is a perfectly subjective judgment of the labeler.
I wonder. Recently, a federal judge in court said that the sadist comics and the sadist paperbacks were the trigger which set off juvenile delinquency.
But do you think the judge is any more competent to judge that than you are? The chemist is more competent to judge than you whether the chemical is in the green peas. You need his help. Do you have to have the judge's help to see what's in the comic
book? You can only judge by results, I'm afraid, in both cases. If you take the poison and it kills you, or if you take the poison and you then commit the crime, the result is there, and I think you have to judge the cause by the effect.
But, Mr. Freemantle, don't you agree that man's attitudes toward the common good changes in relation to books? The Tyndale Bible was suppressed, Shelley's Cenci was suppressed, libraries have suppressed Huckleberry Finn, the Jews wanted to suppress Merchant of Venice, and some of the Catholics wanted to suppress the miracle. Isn't this a matter of changing mores and attitudes, Bruno, Galileo? What do we know about what's good or bad for man in these terms?
Well, I think the individual has, there again I come back to the free choice, it's the individual's right at every given moment, each century of each day, to decide what's good for him. Well, and he has to make that decision and gather together with other people having the same ideas in order to protect himself against certain poisons which are inherent in human society.
May I ask, and I'm sure Miss Freemantle won't think it impertinent, I take it that the Catholic Church goes on the theory that there's an authority. And I, for one, believe that a cardinal has a right to persuade his flock, his parish, not to read a book or read a book. And this is all right by me. He could even pick it, as far as I'm concerned, and say, see this, read the book or don't read the book. But I think the misunderstanding in the United States is developed as if there were one Catholic position as to every book, not as to the question of authority. I wonder if you'd talk on that a moment from
the
Catholic point of view.
Well, certainly, from the Catholic point of view, there is an absolute moral position on the subject of the right of the Church to say what Catholics may read. But the Church varies very much from age to age as to what those books are. For instance, many books which were on the index until 1900 came off, and many books which were not on the index have now recently gone in. For instance, the works of Sartre have just recently gone on, and I believe some of the works of Alexandre Dumas have gone off. It depends on the time and the place.
This is also true by area. In New Orleans, which is a Latin Catholic, as distinguished from an Irish overlaid on Puritan, the standards book by book are different.
That I don't know so much about, but I should imagine. But the index is absolute, but I imagine that the laws by which certain people are allowed to read certain books or use them for classrooms, for instance, vary very much.
Let me raise this question. Miss Freemantle began by saying or implying that as a parent she was concerned that certain literature, if we can call it that, shouldn't be put in the hands of her children. And I think you're correct in saying that a great many parents feel the same way. What position do you gentlemen take about this very important question? What do you do about literature that, to some extent, experts will disagree on the extent, but that to some extent stimulates young people in directions that we don't want them stimulated? What are you going to do about that, despite your disdain for censorship?
Well, it's a problem that every parent, and I have three children, faces in raising his children. what they read is one, unhappily, I think, of the least influences that pour upon them. What they see on television, what they read in the newspapers, what they experience in their everyday life, which is certainly far more meaningful than what they read.
You say reading is not as great an influence, is that?
Not in hours of time, and not in immediacy as to what they see day to day. After all, there's cruelty, there's squalor, there's oppression, there's sadism that they see with their own eyes. They see it on television, they read it in newspapers, they read it in books. And
well,
all
actually,
of these things, a parent has to try to exercise a responsible guiding influence and an interpreting influence to his child.
Let me just follow this up. You think only the parent should exercise.
Well, who else is going to stand in the relation of parent? The police chief of Detroit, a couple of weeks ago, in banning 10 North Frederick, the very distinguished novel, from sale in Detroit, said he was doing so because he didn't want his adolescent boys to read it, thus indicating that he thought, I think, of the entire adult population of Detroit as being to him in the relation of adolescent children to their father. I don't want him as my father. I don't want, in this connection, I don't think many people in Detroit do. Is the state going to assume this parental authority for my children, for your children, for Morris's children? Is a society of other parents going to assume this responsibility for me and my children?
This, of course, was the argument. You mentioned the Pure Food and Drug Act before. This argument did come up at the beginning of the century when there were many people who said, in terms of their own interest, that the state should not be involved in labeling anything, let the buyer beware. And you're, in a sense, saying the same thing now, so I think there is a parallel between what you brought up about our protection against poisons of one kind and your feeling that no one can protect us against these poisons.
Well, I think you're using one word to describe two completely different things. I don't think there's anything more than a pun involved in comparing hydrogen cyanide with a literary expression.
A literary expression in the form of dozens and dozens and dozens of books that...
They may have ill consequences, but it's not a poison like a chemical is a poison. It's not something with a formula that you can define in a test tube and counteract with an antidote.
Well, one last point that I'd like to make. You would admit, though, that there are people who feel that the effects of these books, of certain books, are poisonous.
Yes.
There is a considerable body amongst us.
Don't you get to two other problems? One is, do you censor, on any theory, the book reading habits of our people down to the mush of a feeble-minded or a child? What is the common denominator, number one? Number two, what I think is the most exciting thing in this field of censorship and book reading is that I think we're ready for the first time in the history of man, through the sciences, the social scientists, to get some knowledge as to what causal relationship there is, if any, between a book and behavior. For example, in more than 100 cases I've been in, the male prosecutors usually get up before the jury and say, this book's all right for us men. We've got to protect our women. Well, now, for the first time, we know women are not at all concerned with obscenity. It doesn't affect them at all. Second thing is that on all the attacks on children's reading, comic books, the attacks are invariably in the field of fiction. We now know from the first time through studies of New York University that the fiction material has a totally different impact than the nonfiction. In other words, the daily newspapers, the daily tabloids, in my judgment, are breeding a generation of tasteless, tawdry kids who believe that sadism is normal. I don't for a moment think we ought to have censorship, but to discuss book censorship in the field of sadism while the newspapers are behaving as they are, with reality, this isn't fiction, this throat-cutting girl every day and the murders, this is affecting our tawdry culture.
But there is a connection, I think, with fiction. I know that the other day there was a boy who killed another little boy and stuck the knife in 38 times, and somebody, the judge said to him, why 38 times? And he said, well, that was in the book I'd read, they did it 38 times.
Yes, but it might have been 45 if he hadn't read the book. And I have picked up, as far as I could, every instance of where authorities or authors said, penologists, even my good friend Fred Wortham, wrote two wonderful books about sadism, and in each case, the murderer had been to a movie the night before. Well, I wrote him and said, my dear Fred, before anybody does anything in America, they go to a movie. And in addition to that, both movies had been approved by the Legion of Decency.
I think in any event, when we're talking about this, we have to realize that we're talking about censorship as it actually works. And what the censors censor when they go to work is not merely horror comics. I think the two most systematic efforts at censorship in the country today are the National Organization of Decent Literature list and the Detroit Police Department list. And if you run down those, you will find that a majority of the novels that have won the National Book Award as the most distinguished American novel of the year are on that list. Not some, but most. You'll find that the works of every American Nobel Prize winner in literature are on that list. You'll find that the works of people like Faulkner and Hemingway and O'Hara are on both of those lists. You will find, for example, on the Detroit list, a book on sex instruction for adolescents published by the YMCA and widely used in hundreds of church schools in other parts of the country. You'll find works of Freud, of Havelock Ellis. And when you turn censorship loose, this is what gets censored.
Yes, but who takes notice of it? The NODL has been very careful to say, I happened to write that down because it's in their constitution, they are not to be used for the purposes of boycott or coercion. It's simply a list of people who want to know what a book is about and what type of book it is. And if you don't like the list, you don't have to. You can read all the books that they work against.
They practice frequently.
In fact, if you were interested in pornography, it'd be a very good way of boning up on your library.
What about the practice?
Well, in practice, it differs considerably, I'm afraid, from the intentions of the National Organization of NODL. In quite a number of cases, there is what can only be described as a boycott of dealers who don't agree to post a sign saying they will refuse to sell anything on
the
NODL list. And there's public authority. The prosecutor at Port Huron, Michigan, issued an instruction to everybody selling books in his jurisdiction that if they sold any book then or later listed by NODL, they made themselves subject to prosecution.
Well, then NODL itself ought to protest against that.
That's right.
They ought to protest against any kind of police protection. And should do.
Yes,
I mean, that's perfectly clear, I think. We all agree that this is not
things,
an area for the state.
Two things NODL is short on. One is they ought to protest, as Ms. Freemantle says. And the other is they're exposed to the public the amount of money they spend. See, I'm in favor of disclosure on all fronts. I'd allow people to picket the White House, but I'd like to know who's paying the money for the pickets. Now, I'd like to know whether the NODL spent $100,000 or $1 million last year in disseminating its lists. And number two, they should join with Mr. Lacey and others to prevent their lists being used in an oppressive fashion, to blacklist, secondary boycott.
Well, now,
this would be wonderful if we could get that done.
In other words, you think there should be lists, or there can be lists, of books that individuals or organizations consider to be indecent. Or decent.
Except that once you get a list, you're admitting that the thing is on the borderline. You don't need a list of French postcards to have the police go after those. The mere fact that the only way you can enforce something like this involves a panel debating and getting up a list suggests that the books are not evidently.
But I don't think you want to enforce it. I think you want to give the organization the same, absolutely the same rights and the same freedoms as you give the individual.
Oh, I have not the slightest objection.
There's
no reason why persuasive use of a list.
Well, the American Bureau of Standards has a list which any engineering product has to comply with, and if it doesn't, it's not in that book. It's not on their list. It's no good.
I'm less interested in standard ideas than I am in standard gear shafts.
But no, but I mean the point is that you want to know whether a book comes up to a standard. You have a perfect right to know.
I would defend the NODL's right to publish a list.
Oh, so would I.
To read books or not read them. On the other hand, I think it's about time they called in the scientists when they formulated their lists to see if there's any proof whatsoever of a causal relationship between reading a book and a behavior pattern, as against all the other influences of life, including, if you please, a spring breeze.
But I'm a little afraid that you may use science as other people have used orthodoxy, as something that I have to believe in. I may not accept the findings of your psychiatrist.
I'm not saying they should accept, but all I'm saying is it's better than their subjective guess.
But that's what confuses me here, because first, as far as you're concerned, Mr. Lacey, I gather I don't know whether you're saying that it is appropriate to have such lists.
Oh, I see nothing wrong with the list, no.
You don't think that the list itself implies for the person, the average person who reads of such a list, that there is something wrong with these books, and that in an age when we are fairly much concerned with what others think, we might not steer away from these books. You don't think the list itself
If it's properly identified that this is the opinion of a panel of Catholic mothers in the Archdiocese of Chicago that these books, on the whole, are objectionable reading for Catholic adolescents, I see no objection to the widest possible promulgation of the list. But I object vehemently to the use of the list in ways that prevent people who, knowing the book is on the list, still want to read it from reading it if they choose to do so. And that, unhappily, is the effect.
And I think every Catholic would agree with you there. The freedom of the will
cannot
be taken away.
Not every Catholic, no more than every Protestant would agree with it, I'm afraid. But
suppose, then, we live in a society in which Jewish groups band together and publish lists of books which they consider unpleasant, improper to be read, and they publish these lists and distribute them widely, and then Protestant groups do the same, and television groups do the same, and movie groups do the same. What
Quaker
kind
group.
Of society do we live
I
in
don't
then?
Necessarily
live in a pluralistic
say
society.
This is a wise or useful or practical or sensible use of time, but it's certainly something one has a right to do.
Yes. All that I understand Dan to say is he agrees with me that you wouldn't stop it. As a matter of fact, if there were enough lists and there were disclosure as to money back of them, and there were no attempt to use them for boycott, these lists would wash out each other. This is a good marketplace, too. Some people say read Hemingway, and other people say you can't get to heaven that way, and other people say don't read Hemingway. Or
well, what's happened to the older theme of I'm not concerned with what someone else says I should or shouldn't read? What happens with the older habit in this country of being without such lists, whether distributed by a religious group or a temperance group or what have you? I note that there isn't that feeling at this table today that there is something wrong with the very notion of groups insisting that this book is bad and that book is bad. No one thus far, and I don't know, but that this isn't just our times. No one has said this in itself is bad.
I think his scientist comes in there. I remember reading an article by Margaret Mead in the third issue of A New World Writing, in which she says that unlimited tolerance is impossible in a modern society.
Yes, you see, what these lists should really be is a guide to people to persuade them to read or not read. And bear in mind, this is a different world than originally when people talk about tradition. 1776, the biggest library was 4,000 books. We four people could have read every book, could have been cultured people. Well, now we've got, 12,000 titles a year, new titles. So people are getting guidance by critics, by teachers, by parents, and by organized efforts saying read or don't read. The madness comes in the making up of the lists by people who are easily frightened, and by not disclosing their own lives and selves to the audience. If Miss Fremantle writes for the Times or the Tribune or Review, we have a chance of appraising. We know she's Catholic, number one. We know she's a teacher, number two. But when you get these amorphous lists published, I think it'd be helpful if they said the occupation and the background and the age of every person on the committee that picks the NODL list of books not to be read.
Well, I think there's always a certain danger implicit in any large organization coming out with simply a list of books saying don't read them without characterizing them or reviewing them further. When you've got tens of thousands of books coming out in this country and others, and this whole flow of experience in the media, and you pick 100, 200 titles out and say these don't read, I think there's a great danger that this list, no matter how innocently prepared, becomes used as an instrument of pressure.
Well,
and I don't like them for that reason.
Why don't
reason.
We get the NODL to make up a list of books that people should read?
I wish very
you
much
all agree
that
with
they
that,
would,
the
and
move?
As a matter of fact, I think quite probably they will.
Well, of course, it isn't the NODL that's being discussed here today. Mm-hmm. It's a larger question of book censorship,
right.
And I'm still very much interested and rather fascinated by the fact that no one has said reading any book is an important experience, and every book, if possible, is an important experience for every person. No one has said that it is more important that each book shall be read by all, if that were at all possible.
Because I think to say that would
yes.
be to say that it would be to limit freedom of choice. If you had to read every book, or even had to feel that you had
couldn't.
To.
No, I grant that one can't, and I grant that one shouldn't feel that one should, but here we're putting our emphasis on lists of books drawn up by one group or another. You want the backers of the groups indicated and where their income comes from, etc. But we're putting our emphasis upon this, what I consider to be a very negative approach. I'm just trying to state it for myself.
May I say my answer?
Please.
I believe I trust the American people. So if the advisors and the persuaders, I don't mean the legal instruments, the persuaders, say read a book or don't read, and if they've used such scientific knowledge as we possess as to the effect of any of a book, then on top of it, I'd like to know, for example, how many are celibate, how many are over 80 years of age, how many are under 25. This is persuasive to me. How many of them are teachers at colleges?
So more knowledge, not less. Of,
I'd like to know more about the people who are trying to persuade
me. And there's a question of attitude, too. When a book reviewer writes a book for the, review for the New York Times and says, this is a terrible book, he really doesn't care whether somebody goes out and reads it afterwards. He isn't trying to stop them, actually.
But if it's badly written and the English is lousy, I do care quite for
He doesn't feel parental towards the readers of his review.
Well,
he does.
I do.
Forgive me that I've read many a review that... When I've read the book, I've wondered now, how in the world did this reviewer ever come to this conclusion? That is the thing, that a thought that occurs to me. Whether it's the reviewer or the group that lists the reading that can or cannot be labeled.
Maybe we ought to have two reviewers on all important books and two organizations. Maybe we ought to start the three of us an organization that differs with any list of any organization. Say we disagree.
I think the great point is, as Lord Acton said, that the phrase, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and render unto God the things that are God's, made a tremendous distinction for all time and made possible the kind of groups that we're talking about and that we approve of, because before that, the state had no limits. And now, the limit of the state is very, since then, the limit of the state is very clearly defined by the rights of the individual to make his own association.
I gather you all feel very strongly about state censorship.
Very
governmental censorship.
And particularly the federal government, because the states never delegated to the federal government the power.
But you don't object strenuously to the exercise by the state?
I do, too, because of the vague standards. But New Mexico has no law against censorship. And Indiana wants to import a sex book for one of its universities. How come that the federal government should prevent it coming in?
Well, I think we do agree on the question of the national government at any rate. And thank you so much for our discussion today of book censorship. Ms. Fremantle, Mr. Ernst, Mr. Lacey. Next week on The Open Mind, we're going to continue our discussion of censorship. We'll be talking about movie censorship, an issue that has been very much in the news in recent weeks. Next week, then, our subject will be movie censorship. See you then.
WRCA has just presented The Open Mind. Our guests today were Miss Ann Fremantle, Morris Ernst, and Dan Lacey. Your host on The Open Mind is Richard D. Hefner. If you have any comments or questions on today's program, or if you have any suggestions for future programs, please send them to The Open Mind, WRCA, New York 20, New York.